Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi Tzai. Shalom Aleichem. This is our first Elul Tavshin Peish year. So we're moving into the Elul zone. So we're in Kodesh Halvavah Shah Avodah Selikim, Perek Gimel. In my Lev Tov edition, it's page Reish Beis. In the English edition, page 254. okay, we're in the middle of a lengthy discussion, and we'll just bring ourselves abreast to where we're holding at the moment. The Chovis Halvavis has been banging into us the understanding that we are operating in our service of Hashem. We're operating with two systems. We want to be operating with two systems. We ultimately want to get to two systems. There's the what we've been calling the externally imposed system, meaning a Torah handed down from Hashem, from Shemayim, telling you this is what you must do, this is what you must not do. If you do what you need to do, you get rewarded. If not, and if you do what you shouldn't do, you get punished. It's an external imposed from on top. That's track number one. Track number two is what we've been calling the internally driven system, meaning a person reaches a level of appreciation of Hashem, a level of awe, a level of appreciating the privilege of a relationship, appreciating the privilege of interacting with Hashem, appreciating the privilege that Hashem is interested in him and in what he's doing. And therefore, the person feels an internal drive, feels driven, indebted, and wants to dedicate himself or herself to Hashem, not because of any promise of reward or threat of punishment, but because of an appreciation of Hashem, appreciation of everything we've been getting from Hashem, appreciation of what it means to really be able to have a personal, intimate relationship with the Creator of the entire universe who controls it all. So the Chovis Halvavos has been training us to understand that the first is a stepping stone to the second. It begins with, here is a set of rules that's imposed on you. Apply yourself to it conscientiously, and you'll find yourself moving to a place, if you're going about it right, where you start, if you want to be operating with an alert mind, seeing Hashem around you in your life, till you'll get to a place where you'll feel Hashem in your life, you'll start appreciating Hashem more and more, and you will be, as we've been saying, internally driven to get close to Hashem, to serve Him, to dedicate yourself to Him. So now, at the point where we're holding now, Chovis Halvavos is telling us, since we understand that really the ultimate goal is the internally driven system, to be operating just because it's bursting forth from me. I don't need to be told, reward, punishment. It's bursting forth from me. So, just like, we don't need to be told about our children. Well, care for your children, because otherwise, you are shirking your responsibility and you'll be held accountable in Shemayim. We care for our children because we love them. It's true that if you don't, you'll be shirking your responsibility and you'll be accountable in Shemayim. But we're driven because of our love. So the Chovis Halvavos is now telling us why we still need the Torah, why we still need the externally imposed system, why we can't just say, at least once we've reached the level, now let me just dedicate myself to Hashem. Based on my own internal drive, I don't need the instructions of precisely how to do it. I let my sense of dedication, my sense of gratitude, my love for Hashem dictate the way I'll serve Him. Why do we still need a Torah? So last week, we studied the Chovis Halvavos' first reason, and that is that the Torah provides the perfect balance between, the Torah wants us to merge the spiritual life into material reality. The Torah doesn't want us to be hermits. The Torah doesn't want us to be ascetics. The Torah wants us to be living in the material world. That world as well is authored by Hashem, just as spirituality is. He wants us to even be enjoying the pleasures of this world, but not sunken in them. He wants us to strike that perfect balance of the person who lives in the material world. He's married, he has a family life, which means that he has to support them. He's involved in work. He eats, he drinks, he sleeps, he doesn't deprive himself, he doesn't afflict himself, and yet at the same time he's a spiritual person. He's not a person who is sunken in the physical life. And this is a tricky balance, and we need a divinely imposed system. We need Hashem to provide us with the balance of how to get it right. How on the one hand, yes, to be involved in food and drink, because Hashem wants us to serve Him b'simcha. Hashem wants us to serve Him with a sense of gishmak. While on the other hand, not to become sunken in it. Not to become sunken in it, and therefore Hashem provides mitzvahs that give those outlets that enable you to indulge within the framework of His service, and Hashem provides mitzvahs that check you and says, hey, there are times you're going to have to control your eating. You're going to have to control what you eat, how you eat, when you eat. And there are times that you won't eat at all. And to strike this balance, it's impossible for the human being to strike it, right? We talked about rest on Shabbos as well, right? A person needs to have time to step out of the daily grind, to rejuvenate physically, to rejuvenate spiritually, while at the same time being idle is not healthy for a human being. So that too, how do we strike that balance? The divinely ordained balance is once every 7 days. More than that would be unhealthily idle. Less than that would not give us the chance to rejuvenate physically and spiritually. And the same goes for the extent to which the Yamim Tovim are sprinkled throughout the year. We discussed that also when it comes to business, when it comes to money. And here I want to actually make a point that the Kuzari makes, a very hush of a point when it comes to money. Just like we said last week, if you remember, we said last week that when it comes to food and drink, we don't take the approach that food and drink is something wicked. We take the approach that we have times in the year which are reflective of the way it should work in general. When we're told, V'samachta v'chagecha v'yisach sameach, you should rejoice. How do you rejoice? Yes, there's Yom Kippur also, but there are also the times of year when you're told to indulge, to enjoy. And note, by the way, that the proportion... proportionately, we give more weight to that side of the coin, while it's checked with mitzvahs like Yom Kippur, which keep it from taking over. And at those times, as the Kuzari expressed, such beautiful words from the Kuzari, where he said that you must realize that when a person rejoices and enjoys good food and drink, with the understanding that he's a guest at Hashem's table, and is rejoicing with Hashem, and is enjoying Hashem's bounty, and this creates feelings of closeness with Hashem. He says that avodah is that service is no less cherished by Hashem than your fasting on Yom Kippur. So it's that balance. Now I want to add another thing that the Kuzari says, because this also is such a fundamental point. The Kuzari says, sometimes there will be. I'm going to tell a story to illustrate this point. This is a story that I love because it brings out the greatness of two very, very great people. There was a boy who lived in Ofakim, a chassan, engaged, who lived in Ofakim. Ofakim was the town where the Rav of the town was Rav Shimshon Pinkus, the legendary Rav Shimshon Pinkus, a man who was known as just being a ball of fire, in terms of his fervor and his contagious enthusiasm for Avodas Hashem, which really affected so much of our generation. Rav Shimshon Pinkus ignited the fire of enthusiasm for Hashem in so much of in our generation. If you can get a hold of some of his tapes, his recordings, they're worth hearing. Whatever the case is, he was the Rav of Ofakim, a very sublime person. Now, this boy was engaged to be married. And I didn't understand exactly the technicalities. He had been in an accident earlier in life. And somehow or the other, there was an outstanding insurance claim or something, or some sort of claim. He would be able to cash in a lot of money, but somehow or the other, it could only work if he wasn't married. So in order for him to be able to cash in on this claim, he had already set a date for his wedding. He would have to postpone the date. He would have to postpone the date by a few weeks. Now, we know there's a general idea, a chash of an inyan, that once the wedding date is set, it's considered very inauspicious. We view it as though that is the time in Hashemayim that this couple is slated to be married. And we avoid, to whatever extent we can, changing the date of a wedding. But in this case, there was a large sum of money at stake, and this boy wanted to know if he could postpone the wedding date by a few weeks. So he went to Reb Shimshon Pinkus, and Reb Shimshon Pinkus was unequivocal in saying, absolutely not, you do not change a wedding date because of money. Nothing to talk about. Okay, he got his psak, but he still felt edgy, he still wasn't entirely comfortable with it. It was a lot of money. It could really help, especially toward beginning married life. It was a sizable sum, and he wasn't comfortable. He went back to discuss it until finally, Shimshon Pinkus said, "I see you're not comfortable. You know what? I'm going to be going to Bnei Brak next week. Let's go together to Rav Shach. Go together. Take it to the highest authority alive. Let's go together to Rav Shach." So that's what happened. Reb Shimshon Pinkus and this boy went together to Rav Shach. They told Rav Shach the story, and Rav Shach didn't respond. So what should we do? Rav Shach said, I don't have an answer. I don't know what to say. Okay, they tried. They elaborated more this way, that way, and Rav Shach just said, I don't know what to tell you. I don't have any. I can't answer this question. I don't know what to say. Okay, they left. Rav Shach was very clear about being unclear. He said, I just don't have an answer. I don't know what to say. It's a tough question. I don't know what the answer is. Okay, they left. Now you understand that this chassan's state had not been improved. Now he was even more nervous and even more distraught. Rav Shach isn't giving an answer, and there's a lot of money at stake. And what do I do? So the boy went back to Rav Shach by himself. He came into Rav Shach and he said, tell me what to do. I need to know what to do. I'm stuck here. Rav Shach said, don't postpone the wedding date. He said, very clearly and simply. So Rav Shach saw the boy looking at him, like obviously, like, what happened? When we came the other last week, you were completely torn. You didn't know what to say. Rav Shach said, Lemaisa, Reb Shimshon Pinkus is right. Don't postpone the wedding date, even if there's a lot of money involved. But, Rav Shach said, now listen to this. But, Rav Shach said, by Reb Shimshon Pinkus, money is nothing. He didn't see a question at all. By him, money was simply not a factor. I wanted to convey a message to him. I wanted to convey a message to him that money is something. Money is a consideration. Money is a factor. It has to be weighed. And the answer at the end of the day is, and he's right, still the wedding should not be postponed. What I love about this story is that it so brings out the greatness of these two men. It brings out Reb Shimshon Pinkus' greatness because, this was a man who completely wasn't, in this world, everything material simply meant nothing to him. And it brings out the greatness of Rav Shach in terms of the sense of responsibility of a leader of Klal Yisrael. This is a story that I one of my favorites. Now, by the way, I'm just saying, whenever we tell stories, don't draw practical conclusions from them. We tell a story for the point. If you're ever facing a situation where you can make $1 million if you postpone a wedding, go ask your own Shaila. We certainly don't draw practical conclusions from these stories, but the point is a hush of a point. What's the point that I want to get out of this story? What I want to get out of this story is that sometimes we tend to relate to money, for example, as something very unholy. Money is something unholy. And You know, when we talk spirituality, yeah, keep money out of the picture. Money is not. So the Kuzari here as well makes a very profound statement, profound in its simplicity, which kind of reflects the point that Rav Shach made. The Kuzari says, we do not disparage money. We don't make a value out of disparaging money. We do make a value out of disparaging money turning into a pursuit, money turning into something that takes over one's life, something that pulls a person away from more important values. But we do not disparage money. And therefore, he says, for example, he says, a person is making a lot of money. We don't see that as a conflict to spirituality. There's a lot of spiritual opportunity with money. A person has a lot of great things that he can do with money in terms of spirituality. There's worlds of opportunities for a person who has a lot of money and is willing and ready to spend it in the right way. This is not a mundane person. It could be a mundane person. Money can make a person very mundane, but money can also make a person very sublime when it's used right. Then he goes on and says, and certainly, if we're talking about a person who has a large family, then for him, making money is a value. Making money to support his family comfortably, it's a value. So this is, again, another point related to this issue. The balance that the Torah strikes, how the Torah encourages us, it encourages us to support our families. And it encourages a functioning society. And yet at the same time, it provides all kinds of checks so as to prevent us, all of the laws of integrity, of honesty, so many different halakhas that are supposed to make you so conscious of this. But even besides that, I think we said last week, the halakha of interest, not taking interest, it's there to show you that no, don't capitalize in every way you can. Don't let the money start taking you over and become a pursuit in and of itself. Money, but within a box, within a box. And this is where we need the laws of the Torah to help define these things. Because otherwise, if a person goes on his completely spiritual track, he might say, money is something completely mundane, completely unholy, completely sacrilegious. So we need the Torah to be providing us with that perfect balance of living the spiritual in the material zone. So that's number one. We just elaborated, we spent half hour shir elaborating on the point that we studied last week, but it's a hush of a point, an important point of elaboration. Now let's move on to number two, Vahasheni. That's what I claimed at the beginning of the shir. I claimed we were going to be starting from Vahasheni. Ke'aras HaSeichel, again, I am idiomatically translating that as the internal drive. That's what it means practically. Literally, I guess we call it the intellectual inspiration. What we mean is the internal drive, okay? Eino goyderes chiyuvei maaseh avodah tzedekim. He said, again, it's kind of similar to the first point, but the Chavis HaVavis is very into being very methodical and breaking down all the points fully. So yes, internal drive will get a person to dedicate his life to spirituality. But it will not provide the person with the precise parameters of the various mitzvahs of spirituality, mitfilah, such as prayer, v'tzayim, v'tzedakah, u'maiser, u'gmilas chasadim. Prayer, fasting is often viewed as a spiritual activity, but the Torah has its precise ideas of how much and to what extent. Tzedakah, how much tzedakah should be given. Maiser, chesed. So, point number one is, this is a point that the Rambam makes also, is that even when it comes, these are all mitzvahs that are intuitive. Anybody who develops spiritual sensitivity, right? There are mitzvahs that we relate to as chukim, shatnez, milk with meat, etc. But then there are mitzvahs that are intuitive, that anybody who starts developing spiritual sensitivities would naturally integrate these mitzvahs in his life. Like what? Like what we're saying here. Davening, fasting, tzedakah, chesed. These are all things that a person would naturally do. Nevertheless, the Chavis HaLava says, even within these mitzvahs that a person would naturally do, there's still choik. There's still the element of how does Hashem want you to do them? Because there are lines that Hashem draws. Tefillah, for example. Let's talk about men right now, not women. Let's talk about men right now. To know that it should be 3 times a day, not 5 times a day, not 1 time a day. 3 times a day is the precise recipe of doing it right. Fasting. Now, for women, tefillah is left a bit more open-ended. But women should have some form of tefillah in their day, whether it's not one of the full proper tefillahs, at the very least, Birkas HaShachar. There should be some tefillah in a woman's day, too. And certainly, this is sometimes women are even more capable of what we might say personal tefillahs, just connecting to Hashem verbally throughout the day. But here we have less; we're not given as precise, cut and dried parameters as we are with regard to the 3 formal tefillahs every day. But fasting, right? We're given precise parameters. Tzedakah, Hashem tells you how much He expects you to give. Hashem lays it down. We all are familiar with the concept of Maaser. There are also lines that are drawn. A person can give more than Maaser. A person should not spend more than 1/5 of what he has on Tzedakah. The Torah does not want to create a situation where people are giving so much Tzedakah that they themselves become dependent. Also, other dinim of tzedakah, the law of demachsoiroi, that when you have a poor person, he is entitled to receive from the tzibur what he lacks, and that's actually a complex din, because what a person lacks depends on his general lifestyle. A person who was a very wealthy man and suddenly fell into hard times, actually will be obligated to provide him with more than will be obligated to provide a person who's been poor his whole life, doesn't have very high standards. All he needs is his 2 meals a day in a very basic way, and that's enough. That's what you have to provide for him. A person, a wealthy man, who lost his fortune, you might actually have to provide him with 2 cars and with a high lifestyle. That might sound strange, but there's a very, very fine sensitivity being expressed in the Torah there. You know, it's kind of like Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, that if you see a child who's floating a toy boat on the lake, and then it sinks, and the child is devastated, and he's weeping, etc., and you're like, okay, well, you know, you try to make him feel better, but at the end of the day, it's just a toy boat. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, no. You have to move into the child's world and into the child's mind. The child experienced something of no less magnitude than a rich merchant whose boat full of, if his ship sank, full of merchandise, and he now just suffered the loss of his life. He said, you can't just say, well, me from an adult perspective. You have to, what did this person just experience? What loss did this person just experience? If the child just got his dream toy boat for his afikoman, and now it sank, you have to realize that the child just underwent a tragedy of the same magnitude as a rich man whose boat with all of its merchandise sank. The fact that in your mature world a toy boat is nothing does not mitigate, it doesn't take away from the child's sense of loss. He is not an adult. And you know what? for the rich man, you can have a person who's a good ladar and he'll say, who cares? So a boat full of merchandise sank. You know, Hashem, whatever Hashem does is for the good. It's certainly not the way we're supposed to relate to a person who experienced the loss. We want to relate to a person who experienced the loss in terms of what is he feeling, what is through. The fact that everything that Hashem does is for the good, that's for the person himself to try to sense. But when we're relating to the person, we have to relate to it in terms of what is he feeling, What pain is he going through? So in the same way, you know, you might see, let's say, a wealthy person who had a fleet of cars and had a huge estate, and now he lost so much, he only has 3 cars now, and he had to move into a regular villa, 3 times the size of your house. And you're thinking to yourself, oh, come on, I'm really supposed to feel bad for this person. His lifestyle is still way above what mine is. But you know what? You are supposed to be empathetic. Because for you, living in your house, which is the standard you've always been used to, and it's comfortable for you, is not sad. For him, having been used to that standard, this is something very sad, the fact that now he lives in a house that's 3 times the size of yours. And it's not simple to be capable of being sensitive to that. But these are the sensitivities that the Torah wants of us, and this is all included in the mitzvah of tzedakah. And I just have to add that the truth is that it's not exactly so. As long as a person hasn't yet hit the objective standard of an ani, of a poor person, you're not yet obligated to give him tzedakah. So in the case of the person who's still living in a villa that's 3 times the size of your house, there, you don't yet have an obligation to give him tzedakah to enable him to buy a huge estate again. But what yes is that once that person will drop below the objective poverty line, the obligation of tzedakah will require that. It will require us to restore him to what he's used to. Now, it's a whole discussion in the Gemara. People might be blamed for having developed a very high standard in the first place, but the Torah does expect these sensitivities. So whatever the case is, what we're seeing here is that there are many mitzvahs that might be intuitive, but still the Torah comes and says, yeah, but I have Hashem's idea of exactly how it should be done. Intuitive? It's true. If you would do them on your own, you'd be living a highly ethical and highly moral lifestyle, a highly admirable lifestyle. But if you really want to do it in its full completion, you need Hashem to provide you with the divine parameters of exactly how it's done right. So, therefore he continues and says, "Utzach l'mama d'gvul b'kol zed," Chavis Alvavis continues, he says, therefore, we do need a parameters for all these things. B'derech ha-Torah ve'eras ha-Nevuah. Again, if we remember that this is not about living ethical lives, it's not about living moral lives, but it's about something much more than that. It's living a life that is pleasing to Hashem. We need Hashem to lay down for us exactly how He defines that. So even the mitzvahs that we understand are pleasing to Hashem, we still want Hashem to tell us exactly how they're pleasing to Him. Like, for example, you might be able to appreciate that if you want to please a guest, serve him a steak. But you still might want to know, does this guest like his steak well done, rare, or somewhere in the middle? And how does he like it seasoned? Does he like it very simply seasoned, or perhaps he likes the spices laid on thick? So yes, we can do very, very great acts, but we want to do them in the way that is perfectly pleasing to Hashem. For that, we need Hashem to come and give us his input. And this is why we still need, even after we'll be operating on the internally driven system, this is why we still need the externally imposed parameters, even for the intuitive mitzvahs, in order to help us, in order to enable us to do them in the way that is exactly how Hashem likes. Okay. Now we move on. What's another reason why we require that externally imposed system and the operating with the internal drive will not suffice? So, Vashlishi. Number 3 is, yeah, you may have noticed I didn't complete the paragraph. I do that. I skip. I want to get to I want to learn the main points and not necessarily every word. Vashlishi. Number 3 is, Kaheora hasichlis, the internal drive, einena koileles kol ha-mitzuvim, will not be all-encompassing for all people. Mitnei kutzem achsheves k'tzosam, v'yisuen ha-koras k'tzosam al-k'tzosam. The internal drive, you cannot just have avodas Hashem ride on the internal drive. Why? Because first of all, the internal drive depends on a person being a thinking person. Not everybody are thinking, not everyone are thinking people. That's number one. Number two, even when you're talking about thinking people, some people are more intelligent than others. Some people will have more insight than others. Some people will appreciate more than others. Hashem does not want his service to be limited to the real thinkers, and that the quality of his service should be limited to the most intelligent of the group. Hashem cherishes every member of his nation. And therefore, he provided a system that gives everybody a good, solid place in his service. Even if you're not a thinking person, even if you're a superficial person, even if you're an unintelligent person, Hashem values your service also. He wants the closeness of each of his children, and therefore he provides us with a system that's uniform, that doesn't necessarily depend on intelligence, doesn't necessarily depend on a tendency to think, on a contemplative personality. It doesn't depend on sophistication. This is a set of rules. You want to be close to me. You want me to be proud of you. Just follow this set of rules. So, therefore, Hashem provided the externally imposed system, the externally imposed Torah, which covers everybody who just makes the grade of being commandable. Meaning, you know, I have people, you have a person who, chalila, his mind doesn't work at all. Someone whose mind is completely mentally incompetent. So okay, he's not included in the Torah's commands. But we're talking about people. It doesn't really depend on intelligence level. This provides everybody with a place in Hashem's circle. This provides everybody with a relationship with Hashem in a standard, uniform way. Everybody who's doing this is close to Hashem, is beloved by Hashem, is in his circle. Now, if people want to go and take that further, gesunte heit. But this is a way of ensuring that everybody is included in the fold, everybody is included in the circle, everybody can get very close to Hashem. Even if they differ in their levels of their understanding of the Torah, still, they can all apply themselves, they can all earn Hashem's pleasure and favor. Now he adds another point. It's not just that people differ in their levels of understanding. It's that even when you have a person who's operating with an internal drive, we're going to have ups and downs. Even just taking the individual person, I'm skipping a few words. You can have a person who has ups and downs. Sometimes his internal drive, and this is what we'll all experience, anybody who has developed a taste for spirituality and has enjoyed the feeling of internally motivated avodas Hashem will know that inspiration comes in waves, that the feeling of fulfillment comes in waves, that there are ups and downs. So how will it work? Person operates, rides on the internal drive, he'll do great for 2 weeks, but then he might run out of gas, and then just a week of not functioning at all, a week of no connection with Hashem at all. So therefore Hashem says, no, once again, I'm providing what we'll call an automatic, constant mode of being close with me. It doesn't depend on inspiration. It doesn't depend on how alert you are right now. This is something that you do all the time. Now, add to that the roller coaster of the internal drive. You'll have your ups. You'll have your downs, that's fine, but never will it be a situation where you'll just be off the map. Okay, and then also, he says, that even when you have the internal drive, that itself will lead some people to some places and others to other places. You can have one person who the internal drive will lead him a lot more to, let's say, what we call Ben Adam L'makam, things that are completely in the spiritual realm. But that might be at the expense of Ben Adam L'chaveray, at the expense of the way he relates to other people. Then you can have a person who's a much more like down-to-earth kind of person, and his sense of inner drive will lead him very, very much to doing a lot of chesed, etc. But he may be lacking the more spiritual, the elements of connecting with Hashem more directly. So therefore, Hashem, on the one hand, provides a well-balanced, all-encompassing system that works for everybody all the time. And on top of that, do your roller coaster of internal drive. Let it carry you where your personality takes you. That's all great. But on top of that solid foundation of consistent, straight, unchanging Torah observance, which doesn't differ from personality to personality, it doesn't differ according to intelligence level, it doesn't differ according to stages of life, it doesn't differ according to circumstances. Okay. So that's reason number three of why we require, even assuming that we're on the internally driven track, why we still require the presence of the externally imposed, divinely imposed Torah in our life. Now number four, V'haravi, again skipping the rest of the paragraph, V'haravi, number four is, and this is another fundamental point, Ki mina yadua, he says we all understand, Ki avoidus b'nei adam chayovim b'hem, that when it comes to what level of dedication is expected from a person, Kifi malis hatoivus aleim, it depends on what he received, meaning like this, you have to be grateful. What does gratitude mean? Well, it includes reciprocation. How much do I have to reciprocate? Let's say someone comes and says, I've received goodness from many people. I would like to reciprocate. Please give me a formula for reciprocating. I say, go and tell each person thank you. Well, that's a nice beginning. Go write each person a card. No, 1 minute. It doesn't start from there. It starts from, well, what did each person do for you? You know, so, oh, what did each person do for me? Oh, again, I got favors from a whole bunch of people. One is my uncle. My uncle, he bought me a house when I got married. Okay? Another is a neighbor. I was stuck at a meter without a quarter, and he gave me a quarter for the meter. So I'm grateful to him, too. Then the third is my mother. My mother raised me and took care of me my entire life. So you see, I have a list of people that I'm grateful to. Please tell me how to reciprocate. So what is it? Is it a card to each of them? Hey, 1 minute. It obviously depends on what you got from each one. The neighbor who gave you a quarter when you were stuck without one, give him a very nice thank you. The uncle. Oh, the uncle deserves a whole, it's a whole different planet of recognition and gratitude that you owe to him for buying you a house. And your mother who actually provided you with life. Oh boy. So when we're talking about reciprocation, when we're talking about dedication, it very much has to do with what did you get from the other party. So therefore he says, he says when we talk about our debt of gratitude to Hashem, you have to take into account many things. You have to take into account your own personal life. You have to take into account your family situation. It's another added layer to be grateful for. You have to take into account the nation that you're in. What are the benefits that the nation that you are a part of received? Also, the Chavis of Avos Mamish goes through this. Many, many layers you have to take into account. So, first of all, let's say you're following everything that we discussed in Shaar Bechina. You see all the different aspects of your body. You study all of the normal things that human beings enjoy, and you learn to appreciate that these are all gifts. That requires a certain level of dedication to Hashem. That really requires a high level of dedication and gratitude to Hashem. Then you add to that another layer. Another layer. Look at the family you're in. Do you enjoy a warm family setting? Parents, spouse, children, extended family. That's a whole added dimension to the fact that you are a well-functioning human being. And then, again, I'm keeping it short, and I'm not getting into everything, but then, one minute, are you part of a nation that was shown special favor by Hashem? Are you part of a nation that really should have been a slave race today? But Hashem turned you into a free, dignified, successful nation? Ah, that adds a whole added layer of dedication to Hashem. So now, he says, now, I want to add more to that. Now, let's say you're a part of that nation, but you know what? Many generations have gone by, and there have been many attempts to wipe you out, to destroy the nation you are. And uncannily, unnaturally, you're still here. That adds even more levels of indebtedness. So he says, "V'chol dav adam ischad sheisivus la'am zolosiam acher." Every generation brings reasons, brings special benefits to one nation over another. Mevius liyaktam batoyva meis Hashem yisale. Certain nations will be enjoying more specific benefits from Hashem than others. This is a very central theme of the Chavis Alvavis. The more you receive, the more you must step up your own personal Avodas Hashem. If you have, as an individual, enjoy more benefit from Hashem than the next person, that has to be reflected in your level of dedication. If you, as a nation, enjoy more benefit, more favor, more special attention from Hashem than a different nation, then that has to be reflected in your level of dedication. If your generation enjoyed more favor from Hashem than other generations, take that into account too, besides being the Jewish nation. We are a nation that was provided, talking in terms of historic perspective, we were provided a much more pampered existence, a much more luxurious existence, a much more secure, safe existence than so many of our predecessors. That also has to be reflected in our level of dedication, in our level of gratitude to Hashem. So here he says, just working with internal drive wouldn't be enough. Because what would occur to a person naturally, he expounds on this elsewhere, but this is really the point that he's making here too. What occurs to a person naturally, when a person really starts sensing all of Hashem's goodness to him and starts dedicating himself to Hashem, all of those are really just the effect of the very fact that you're a human being with a properly functioning body. That's what dedicates, that's what requires, that's what obligates you to all of the natural senses of dedication to Hashem that would come. But when you take into account that actually you're part of a nation that enjoyed extra levels of favor from Hashem, now all of a sudden you have to step your avodah up and you don't know where. All the naturally intuitive things you're doing because you feel indebted because of the very fact that you're a human being with all of the human being's proper functions. What are you supposed to add to that? Ah, here you need a whole added layer of dedication that you don't even have the means of comprehending. Here's where Hashem comes and says, oh, you want to add now to the naturally intuited level of dedication? I'll provide you with instructions of how to do it. This really deserves more elaboration, but Lee Neder will continue elaborating on it next week. But we'll stop here for today. We'll unmute and we'll stop the recording, we'll unmute and we'll part.